Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Nice one. So, Rob, thanks for joining me.
No, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be on.
So, tell me a bit about yourself. So, we're obviously going to discuss some paramedic RSI. And airway stuff in general, but before we do, maybe you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit and tell me a bit about your background.
Yeah, no worries. So my name's Rob. I'm on Twitter. It's AmboPhone. You can find me there, usually twittering away about nothing much in particular. I'm an intensive care paramedic, what we call a MICA, paramedic mobile intensive care ambulance paramedic in Victoria, Australia. It's a role I've been in for about 16 years. So I've been a paramedic about 23, 24 years and intensive care for the last 16 or so. My substantive role is as a MICA intensive care paramedic educator, and I'm currently filling a role as a clinical support officer, which is a senior intensive care paramedic who has a lot of input into clinical performance, education, clinical support, obviously, as the name suggests, and we also run the clinical desk, so we're the point of contact for in-field paramedics and the liaison point between other health services.
So what kind of got you into the intensive care stuff? So is there, so like in the UK, we've got a few different avenues in terms of specialising, generally critical care or urgent emergency care, although there are other kind of roles developing. So is that, are they options you have in where you work, or what kind of led you to the critical care route?
Yeah, so basically most of, certainly Victoria and a lot of Australia, or Australasia for that matter, have tiered systems. Some of them are two tiers, some of them are more. So in Victoria we run a two-tiered system. We have the bulk of our workforce, or what we call advanced life support paramedics. So they're all degree qualified for entering the job, so undergraduate degree in paramedicine or health science or something similar. And then there are sort of multiple avenues you can go once you're an ALS paramedic. There's management pathways and there's education pathways and so forth. But we have a two-tiered system, so one of the pathways is the intensive care or MICA side of things. And the idea being, similar to a lot of jurisdictions, is there's a smaller number of hopefully highly trained and experienced paramedics to provide support for the critically ill or injured.
Yeah, no.
Which may or may not work depending on how busy we are.
We'll talk about more about that in a second, I guess. But so what, when you specialise, what, so you mentioned that the ALS paramedics are degree trained, which is again similar to the UK, but what kind of further training do you do for the MICA role?
Yeah, so it's a postgraduate diploma with the option of sort of rounding out to a master's with just a couple more papers. So essentially the process is, so for a civilian to become a paramedic or a MICA paramedic, you do your 3-year undergraduate and then you're employed. If you're lucky enough to be employed, you are employed as a graduate paramedic, which takes another 12 months. And there are this formal education, direct supervision, hurdles to pass and so forth. After that, you are qualified but considered a junior advanced life support paramedic. So you can't work with students, for example, graduates. Right. And generally speaking, you won't be rostered at the same level. You'll still be rostered with someone senior. So not direct supervision, but still recognising that you're finding your feet. So once you've got through all that, so that's about 5 years. Once you've got through all that, you have the opportunity to become an intensive care paramedic. Usually people will leave it a bit longer than that just to make sure they, you know, get the experience and work out what it is they need to do. So once you decide that you want to be a MICA paramedic, assuming again you're successful, there's another 12 months of training, so a postgraduate diploma, which is currently offered through Monash University in Victoria, and then another 12 months after that of direct supervision, after which time you are a qualified MICA paramedic. However, appropriate to our conversation today, you're not authorised to RSI on your own at that point. There's another 6 to 12 months, depending on how things go, before you can actually independently RSI. So it's a reasonably long sort of pathway to follow. But if we're going to be doing things like RSI, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And it's surprisingly similar, actually. Well, I don't know if it's surprising, because I'm sure the senior people in all the ambulance services talk to each other, but our system is very similar. So in the UK, I don't know how much you know, but basically they, since I think a couple of years ago, the our registering body made a degree entry mandatory. And so for the last few years, certainly, it's again a degree trained profession, and then with 3 years experience in most services, you can apply for a specialist role. And then again, it's different depending where you go in the country, but the critical care role, as we call it, critical care paramedics, is similar. So generally 2 to 3 years, depending whether you do the master's top up or not. And so given that, I wonder, so we don't do paramedic RSI in the UK, but in terms of other interventions, what is your kind of scope of practice as a as an intensive care paramedic?
Yeah, so pretty bog standard, I would imagine, across certainly UK and Australasian and probably Canadian, I would say. Definitely the US is a bit different for a lot of reasons. But it's the sort of bread and butter stuff like cardiac arrest management, intubation without RSI, obviously, anti-arrhythmics, pressors, you know, vasopressors, inotropes, cardioversion, thoracostomies, those sorts of things. So the advanced life support skill set is actually pretty good in Victoria. IV cannulation, IV pain relief with fentanyl, morphine or ketamine under consultation, intranasal fentanyl, midazolam for seizures and agitation, ALS paramedics carry droperidol, ketamine for agitation, and all the usual sort of cardiac drugs as well, GTNs and aspirin and so forth. Depending on where we work in Victoria, so if we're in a rural area, we also have thrombolysis. So for intensive care paramedics, that's thrombolysis sort of off their own bat. For advanced life support paramedics, it's under consultation with a cardiologist. So we've got a reasonably good scope of practice. There's always more stuff I want, but generally speaking, I think we can cover most things pretty well.
Yeah, nice. As you say, it sounds relatively similar. I think so our version of ALS paramedics don't have quite the scope of practice. So the UK, I think, are generally speaking, a lot more careful with sedation and analgesia, often to the detriment of some patient groups. So things like paediatric pain relief, we don't have a lot of options for. And paramedics, and not non-specialist paramedics, generally don't have ketamine or midaz. Certainly not. Can't sedate agitated patients, and again, it kind of limits you in terms of analgesia. But then I guess geographically, we're normally within half an hour of a hospital, which I guess makes quite a difference.
Yeah, it certainly, geography and logistics makes a huge difference. So there are restrictions on ALS practice as well. So if, for example, an ALS paramedic is going to use ketamine to sedate a patient, it's a mandatory request for intensive care backup. Likewise, they do carry a lot of options for analgesia, but it's only for adult, which for our purposes in that realm is sort of above 12 years of age, where it's, you know, essentially physiologically adult, easy to get cannulation and so forth. So for anything younger than that, again, if you want analgesia outside of intranasal fentanyl, for example, which we can give to any paramedic can give to any age, intensive care are required for that sort of thing. So I think the scope is a good one in terms of lots of options with some sort of safety netting in place around the how and when and what support you get if you're going down a particular pathway.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And so obviously we're going to talk about paramedic RSI is the topic for today. So is that something that's always been in the skill set of yourself as like an intensive care paramedic, or is that something that's been brought in recently? How long have you guys been doing that?
It still feels kind of new sometimes, although we've been doing it just over 20 years now. So it's a very well-established part of intensive care practice here. So we ran trials about 20 years or just over 20 years ago, which probably many of your listeners will be familiar with, the Barnard pre-hospital RSI trial, which is one of the few that showed potential benefit to pre-hospital RSI and traumatic brain injury. There's been criticisms of that study in terms of who was included and excluded, but even the most sort of pessimistic read of that Barnard trial with the early deaths in the paramedic arm would suggest that at the very least we are doing no harm with RSI. So if we can safely manage a patient.
I think I read this paper. Is this about like RSI and traumatic brain injury?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So Stephen Barnard was our medical director. We now have Stephen's retired, Dr. Barnard's retired, and we have David Anderson, who's an ex-paramedic, and currently an intensivist and our medical director. But Dr. Barnard was instrumental in sort of pushing pre-hospital RSI in terms of a systematic, researched and safe approach as opposed to the sort of ad hoc approach that had been previously operated and some ways is still operated in some jurisdictions around the world. So he was the sort of the impetus behind that. And we certainly demonstrated, so at the very least, that pre-hospital RSI by paramedics in traumatic brain injury was safe.
Yeah, and so what was the I mean, I'll stick the paper in the show notes because I think it'll be interesting for listeners, but what was the you know, what kind of initiated that as an intervention? What made people think that was necessary for paramedics, certainly out of hospital?
Yeah, so trauma in Victoria is has always been and continues to be largely road trauma. We don't tend to have shootings, stabbings. I mean, we have all of those things, obviously, but the bulk of our trauma was road trauma, and it came with a fairly heavy burden of traumatic brain injury. And so what we were finding was, you know, intubation has essentially always been part of the skill set of microparamedics, and paramedics were starting to drive the sort of push towards needing RSI. So we had the ability to sedate to intubate patients. So back in the bad old days, it was morphine and diazepam and a strong left arm. And it was paramedics, particularly some of our HIMS paramedics, but also some of our ground-based paramedics, who recognised that that was really suboptimal for our patients. And so there was sort of a push from the paramedic side of things to improve things. And we're fortunate enough with Steve Bernardis, our medical director, who was open to that conversation with paramedics and decided to go ahead with it. And I think certainly the difference, even if it's not quote unquote beneficial in terms of improved mortality, if it's not harmful, the difference between a coughing, gagging, bucking, spewing, agitated, head injured patient in the back of an ambulance and someone calmly and quietly, safely intubated and transported is night and day. And I would certainly never want to go back to not having RSI.
Yeah, right. And has there been, there's obviously that kind of pivotal study that you mentioned, but has there been much research into, because it seems like, as you say, the anecdotally, it seems like there's definite benefits, even if it doesn't, you know, if, obviously you need quite significant numbers to prove a significant mortality benefit and things, but there's all those kind of soft factors that I think are really beneficial in terms of, as you say, a tubed, ventilated patient on handover, safer transfer, easier for the crew to recognise deterioration. I mean, there's so many potential benefits. It seems like if the trials were done, the evidence would be strongly in favour, although I'm sure we're both biased in that regard.
Yeah, look, I think the best that can be said is that done well, pre-hospital RSI is safe. And I firmly believe that if that is the case, so if an organisation and paramedics are able to demonstrate that they are able to safely intubate a patient with RSI without desaturation and hypoxia and hypertension and hypercapnia and all those elements that we know negatively impact brain injured patients, if we can safely do that, then I think it behooves us to do it for the betterment of our patients. So are we going to, you know, is it a matter of living or dying? Perhaps not. But likewise, you know, if you're talking about ICP and managing that, a patient who's, you know, fighting and struggling and spewing is not going to be doing their ICP any good either, let alone anything else. And I think one of the issues that's arisen when you start looking at some of the papers from around the world, the issue is probably not paramedic RSI. The issue is RSI done well or RSI done poorly. So a lot of the studies, particularly out of the States, so Henry Wang is a reasonably prolific author, Dr. Wang.
The heart trial, wasn't it?
And yes, yeah. He, you know, There's a narrative that constantly comes out of our paramedics shouldn't be RSI. And then you look at the data and go, well, you're dealing with a cohort of paramedics who have a 50% success rate at intubation. No, they shouldn't be RSI. That doesn't mean that pre-hospital paramedic RSI is bad. It just means that people who are doing it badly shouldn't be doing it. The patient doesn't care who does it.
Yeah. And this is an interesting thing. So a few colleagues and I wrote a paper recently where we realised as a team is we don't really have we didn't have the data on success of intubation for specialist paramedics like in our program, and so we did a retrospective review on that, and in doing that we looked at some of that literature. So the Park trial, as you say, from the USA, we looked at that paper that you mentioned from Dr. Bernard, and so London Ambulance Service have published some data as well to show things like first pass success essentially was our primary outcome. And what I found was interesting was that the success rate in some of those in that Park trial was poor. But the system in the USA, as I'm sure you know, like in the States, in different states, there's different varying levels of education. And what we found was a kind of correlation in that, as we've mentioned, your system in Victoria and the system in the UK is very similar in terms of the training and education. And that seems to come out in the data as well, that the first pass success rates are similar, kind of 90-95%+. And systems where the training is lesser or the education journey is shorter, the first pass success is lower, which you kind of, that's not surprising. And I think what we took from that, and as you're saying, is it doesn't really matter if you're a paramedic or a doctor or a nurse or who you are. It's about the operator, the amount of education and the experience and exposure, isn't it? And so for me, the conversation is, although we're talking about paramedic RSI, I guess the conversation is less about, or I think the conversation should be less about paramedic versus doctor RSI and more about operator experience RSI, I guess.
Yeah, look, I absolutely agree. I don't think it matters. And when we look at some of, Victoria doesn't run doctors in any primary setting. So we have Adult Retrieval Victoria, which is physician-led for retrieval into hospital retrieval, but we don't have doctors on our primaries, either ground or air.
Yeah.
However, when we look at some of the other states in Victoria, so New South Wales, for example, with Sydney HEMS in particular, they run a mixed model of physician and paramedic, and it's not really a matter of who's who. Either the paramedic or the physician can intubate and does intubate. Likewise, South Australia's MedStar run a retrieval practitioner model, where it doesn't matter whether you're a nurse, a paramedic, a physician, it's your retrieval practitioner, and the crew mix is determined based on what the job is and what's needed. And likewise, intubation isn't solely the domain of one of those specialties. And I think that's the sort of enlightened way to go about it. RSI is very much not about what epaulet you wear or what letters are after your name. It is about, as you say, education, but it's also about a system. And it's the system needs to support whoever is RSI with strong oversight, quality assurance, quality improvement, audit, and so on and so forth. And if an organisation is not willing or able to do that, they probably have no place in RSI, whether it's physicians, nurses, doctors, anyone.
Yeah, no, and I think that's...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Fair. Which kind of leads me on to the question of clinical governance, which is obviously a big part of that quality audit and quality improvement. So we in our role we have kind of regular clinical governance sessions, and we talk about sedation jobs or complex jobs. Presumably that's something that is mandatory with RSI. So does that play a big part in it? What are the kind of quality audit factors are there for you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a major part of the process, and I don't think we wouldn't be where we are today without a strong audit process and a strong quality assurance process. So we have a number of clinical KPIs, and what we call limited occurrence screening jobs. So any job that involves intubation, whether it's RSI or cold tubing, any job that involves front of neck access, thoracostomy, sedation for agitation, cardioversion, STEMI cases. There's a whole raft of cases that are reviewed at multiple levels throughout the organisation. So in terms of RSI, every case is obviously documented. All the data off our monitor, so all our SpO2 and entitle and ECG and BPs and so forth is sent to the cloud so that can be retrieved and reviewed. And it's then reviewed at multiple levels. So the first port of call is at a station level or branch level, where a paramedic educator or team manager will review the case. And it's reviewed against a sort of set of criteria. So how long did the procedure take, first pass success, desaturation, so on and so forth, all the sort of things you'd expect to be associated with clinical governance around RSI. That is all entered into a database, and the cases are all then reviewed further up as well. We have limited occurrence screening sort of committees. We have critical incident committees who look at any of those sorts of things where things haven't gone well. We have, you know, quite a number of people who look at every single case. And it's not just, you know, what were the numbers like, what were the SATs like. It's also around decision making. Was it a, what was your rationale for intubating this patient? You know, was it reasonable? Was it unreasonable? We've recently overhauled our guidelines. So we used to have a very rigid set of criteria based on pathology. So if traumatic brain injury, would RSI with a certain cocktail of drugs, and if non-traumatic brain injury, strokes, bleeds, we'd do something else, and so on and so forth. And 4 or 5 years, I suppose, ago, we really overhauled everything and made it about the main reasons we actually intubate: protection of the airway, oxygenation, ventilation, expected clinical course, or humane reasons. Mm-hmm. Took out all the extraneous stuff. So there's a lot more emphasis now on the actual decision making, as opposed to condition X, intubation, condition Y, no intubation.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess the question, so in the UK, we have, because you mentioned the different systems that operate in Victoria and why maybe there's a place for paramedic RSI where there's no out-of-hospital doctor-led service. So in the UK, we have air ambulance coverage across the country, and obviously it's quite small, so the coverage is easier, or response times are much easier. And so things like airway management for traumatic brain injury and those clinical indications you mentioned are predominantly the role of air ambulance services, and there's no real, because of that, there's no real need for anyone else to deliver that. Potentially arguable, but I think that's the kind of stance. What I found in practice is, yeah, we go to, as paramedics, we go to a lot of cardiac arrests, medical cardiac arrests, and there's a kind of de-emphasis on intubation in recent years, given the popularity of the eye gel, the effectiveness and ease of use of the eye gel, and so a lot of services are removing paramedic intubation actually for non-specialists. And so most cardiac arrests we go to now, they are resuscitated with a supraglottic airway, and then they ROSC, if they ROSC, without a tube. And then you're kind of in the situation where the patient really needs to be intubated, but there's going to be a time delay for an air ambulance service to get to you, or a time delay to get to hospital. And so the position we're often in is actually that if paramedic or specialist paramedic RSI were appropriate in the UK, in my opinion, that would be for a post-ROSC patient rather than a head injured patient, as we've discussed. So is that something, I mean, in terms of the patients you're seeing, are they generally trauma, as you mentioned, or do you see a number of post-ROSC patients as well? What's your experience there?
No, so the vast majority of RSIs we undertake now are not in trauma cases. So I think stroke or neurological event is the foremost reason people are getting intubated, but post-ROSC overdoses, hangings, hypothermia, drownings, there's a raft of things. And the actual traumatic brain injury, although it was the sort of genesis of pre-hospital RSI for us, is actually the sort of one of the smallest slices of the pie of what we intubate. And I think one of the good things is that we've gained our experience and now we can use RSI in a lot wider cohort of people because we know we can do it safely, and therefore the hypoxic post-overdose who doesn't wake up and thrashes around, we can make them safe, we can make us safe, we can maximise their oxygenation, improve their ventilation, we can do all the things we need to do because we know we can do it safely and we know we can do it effectively. We don't have outcome data for that. I'm not convinced that we need outcome data for that unless we were thought to be harming people. Clearly we need outcome data, but I don't think that needs a study per se to say your GCS of 6 agitated, hypoxic, post-hanging or so, whatever, shouldn't get intubated. That's just nonsensical. Of course they need intubated and managed, but only if it's done safely. So, yeah, we actually, and the arrest thing is interesting. We've had a similar de-emphasis of intra-arrest intubation, and the vast majority of our cases are managed with an IGEL. So our ALS paramedics can insert IGELs and gastric tubes down the IGEL as well. So that's usually their first. It's the first port of call. And then we tend to RSI post-arrest, depending on the circumstance. We can still elect to intubate during the arrest. I personally quite frequently do, but only if it's possible without any interruption to CPR or get in the way of any of the things that actually matter. Quite happy to have a look and pop a tube in if it's possible, and if it's not, go back to LMA and carry on.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of situation we find ourselves in, where post-ROSC, so it's a bit of a strange one for us. So post-ROSC RSI, we don't have that ability. We don't do any sort of drug-assisted airway management. But if we have a ROSC patient who is intubated intra-arrest, then there's a lot more we can do in terms of post-ROSC care. So we can paralyze sedation package, and obviously that improves or makes ventilation strategies a bit easier. And so what anecdotally you find is that although clinically intubation isn't indicated intra-arrest, kind of thinking forward to the ROSC phase, a lot of people will try and intubate, or a lot of specialist paramedics will try and intubate intra-arrest. And that just leads to, if you can safely do it, that's fine. And we're probably getting quite good at doing that, I would imagine, just from the exposure. But it does potentially take away, or it takes up some of your bandwidth for managing the cardiac arrest, doesn't it? And it's okay if it's a relatively simple cardiac arrest in terms of the management, and you have a number of paramedics who can provide clinical interventions. But often we work with non-paramedic crews and very newly qualified crews, and so there's quite a burden of clinical interventions, and then you just find you kind of get saturated with tasks, and it makes the management more complicated, which is kind of an interesting point to reflect on, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's dead right. And so certainly in metropolitan Melbourne, where I work, so I work in the western suburbs of Melbourne, it's large, populous, and not as well resourced as the wealthy parts of the city, but relatively well resourced. So we have, at a cardiac arrest, for example, we will have a sort of baseline resourcing of 2 advanced life support paramedics, two MICA paramedics, so that's either on a truck or two single responders, and three to four firefighters to do the heavy lifting and the CPR for us. Yeah. So that makes the running of a normal cardiac arrest pretty easy when we have that degree of resourcing. But I, you raise a very valid point, and if fiddling around with an airway is taking away from things that actually matter and bandwidth, I don't think it's reasonable to do that. And if it interrupts CPR, it's absolutely unreasonable to do it.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And so in terms of, so you mentioned obviously the quality audit and monitoring. How are you measuring kind of safety in terms of RSI? Because I think in the literature about airway management and intubation in general, there's a lot of talk about first pass success. But I think it obviously gets more complicated with drug assisted airway and RSI airway management, because there is, I would say, you know, first pass success, a high first pass success is very important, but there's obviously other factors. You mentioned desaturation, hypotension, but they're these kind of drug associated factors. Do you see drug reactions, kind of a negative adverse effects, and how do you monitor, keep an eye on that?
Yeah, so we definitely monitor all of that. So first pass success is important and a necessary, but by no means complete measure of success of an RSI program or an intubation program. It's the first step and one we all need to get to grips with. But it's by no means adequate in and of itself to measure how well we're doing. So we also measure all of our physiological parameters that we can, so end tidal, SpO2, heart rate, blood pressure, throughout the procedure, and all that data is uploaded. So we're currently using Zoll monitors and they upload to a cloud, and all of that data is reviewed every time we do a case, and it's fascinating to see real-time sort of playback of a case, and what you thought took forever took a few seconds, and vice versa. And it's a really powerful learning tool. It also forms part of our audit. So desaturation, hypotension, we measure higher sats or sats immediately preceding the intubation, and sats immediately afterwards. We have... we look at the bundle of care post-intubation, so ensuring the patient's adequately analgised and sedated, making sure that there's no signs of under-sedation, ongoing paralysis should it be required, ventilation settings. So we're sort of moving beyond now as our system's matured and we've matured alongside it. We're moving a bit away from sort of blunt measure of first pass success, still very important, we're still very proud of it, and we're looking more at the sort of totality of the job. Time is one of the issues we continue to have. We've noticed in recent years, and talking to medical colleagues around Victoria, we're not alone in this, but an RSI from go to woe is taking longer than it used to. And sometimes time can get away on crews and blow out to perhaps unreasonable lengths, because I don't think it matters how well you do your job. If it's done sitting on scene without moving towards definitive care in a reasonable time frame, we're probably not doing anyone any favours. So there's always that balance in pre-hospital care of time spent on scene to stay and stabilise versus transport. I don't like the term stay and play. We're not playing. We need to do what is required to make our patient at least safe, if not better. But if things take too long, then we're probably doing our patients a disservice. So that's something we're grappling with at the moment, is how long is too long and what can we do to make it quicker but safe.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.